The court will hear argument in number 21-1986, Feist against the United States. Ms. Key, please begin whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, Elizabeth Key representing plaintiff appellant Dr. Robert Feist. Your Honors, the Primary Care Incentive Payment Program, or PCIP, which was in effect from 2011 until 2016, mandated that the federal government pay certain primary care practitioners a 10% incentive payment for certain primary care services. It is undisputed that Dr. Feist was entitled to receive payments under the PCIP.
Is that correct, counsel? I thought it was disputed whether he was properly coded to receive payments.
Your Honor, it's our position that the evidence is clear that Dr. Feist was in fact entitled to payment. There's a bit of discrepancy in the record as to what.
Isn't the issue not whether the facts support his proper coding? It's that he actually, in fact, is coded a certain way that doesn't entitle him to payments. Isn't it true that his coding did not entitle him to payments, whether that coding is correct or not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so the problem is you need to go to a court or an administrative body that can correct that coding, right?
Your Honor, we disagree that Dr. Feist's claim ultimately centers on his identification as a primary care practitioner. We think that the language of subpart 4 is clear. It's limited to a certain kind of claims. It's claims respecting identification. Of course, any claim under the PCIP in some form or fashion is going to involve identification. You're not entitled to PCIP payments unless you're identified to be a primary care practitioner. But what I don't think that the bar on judicial review means is that the government can make a simple mistake and thereby deprive an eligible practitioner from the payments to which he or she is entitled. So I think an example helps illustrate what I think Congress intended to bar from judicial review by enacting a bar on this category of identification of primary care practitioners. So take, for example, an oncologist who would be a specialist, and that oncologist provides primarily non-primary care services to patients that pay cash or have commercial insurance. But on occasion, the specialist provides primary care services to Medicare patients on the referral of family or friends. So when the specialist does bill Medicare, it's always for primary care services. So they easily meet the statutory threshold of 60% primary care services. So the CMS nonetheless determines that the specialist is not eligible for primary care for payments under the PCIP because a specialist is a specialist and they don't have a primary care designation. That physician wants to appeal. He says, you know, I should be.
I understand all this. My issue is, why were you in the Court of Federal Claims? What you're trying to argue against is that they've been improperly disqualified because they're not being treated as a primary care physician. The Court of Federal Claims is a court of, you know, defined jurisdiction, and it only allows claims for money, in this case, based upon a statute. The statute requires that they be coded as a specific type of doctor before they get payment, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, we believe that.
You can't meet that requirement because he's been incorrectly coded or incorrectly treated or whatever. There may be some other avenues for judicial review, but why is it in the Court of Federal Claims?
Your Honor, we believe that there's Tucker Act jurisdiction for Dr. Feist's claims against the federal government because it violated an unambiguous statutory mandate that it pay eligible physicians. And there is clear evidence, as the lower court twice found, that Dr. Feist was in fact eligible to such payments. And so this is a clear, we contend this is a clear Tucker Act claim. There was this unambiguous shall pay language that requires the federal government to in fact pay eligible physicians. We have submitted evidence that Dr. Feist was in fact eligible physician. And so the really the thrust of Dr. Feist's claim is that the government should be forced to rectify whatever internal error it committed. And in fact,
okay, so I get your argument on that, that, you know, you might have some argument there if you made a direct appeal, but we're on a 60B motion, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it's an abuse of discretion standard on whether the court should have reopened that. And your argument is these two Supreme Court cases were grounds. But what do the Supreme Court cases have to do with anything here? There's no dispute by the government that if he was qualified, this is a money-mandating statute. Why do these cases say anything beyond if there's an obligation, you have to pay, which we already knew?
Sure. So, Your Honor, the Supreme Court announced a directive in Maine Community Health Options, which we contend is a supervening change in law which warrants Rule 60 relief here. So,
what was the change in law that wasn't already existing? I mean, your argument to me just now was the statute was very clear that doctors like your client were entitled to money under the statute. The Maine healthcare case didn't say anything about that statute, and it didn't change the nature of what a money-mandating statute was. So why would that be sufficient for a Rule 60B change in law?
Your Honor, so of course there is a different payment mechanism at issue in Maine Community Health Options. There's the Risk Corridors Program, and here it's the PCIP, of course. We contend that that distinction is immaterial. Both cases fall within the statutory scheme of the Affordable Care Act, and they both involve mandatory shall pay language. In the case of Maine Community Health Options, the question on appeal is whether the federal government was in fact required to pay insurers the full amount of the cost sharing reduction payments by virtue of this unambiguous shall pay language.
Can I interrupt you a minute? Do you think there was any dispute that the government had to pay the Medicare payment under the specific statute we're talking about in your case? Did the government ever oppose the notion that it had to pay these premiums under the statute?
The government took the position in Maine Community Health Options.
Not in Maine Community, in your case. Has there ever been any dispute about whether that statute required payment?
Well, Your Honor, the government has taken the position that
in your case, as a whole, the government would agree that if somebody is a primary care physician, they're entitled to payment of money under that statute, correct?
Correct.
They agreed with that before Maine Community, correct?
That's correct.
So what does Maine Community have to do with this case at all?
What Maine Community tells us about this case is how to construe the bar to judicial review in light of the mandatory shall pay language. So in Maine Community, there was the same language.
In Maine Community did not involve a bar to judicial review, right?
That's right. But the similarity is this. If I'm in the most basic terms, there's clear congressional intent shown by shall pay language. That's the same in both cases. What's also the same in both cases is something else. In the case of Maine Community, the something else is Congress's independent decision not to appropriate funds for the Risk Corridors program. The Supreme Court said even that Congress's independent decision that it wasn't going to fund the program was not enough to trump the clear statutory language. We submit that logic applies equally here.
Let me make sure I understand. So your view is that the judicial bar, the bar on judicial review or administrative review should be, that that's analogous to what was at issue in Maine Community Health in terms of not funding the payments?
It's not analogous in the sense that it has to do with the allocation of funds. It's analogous in a more basic sense. There's two acts of Congress, right? There's the act of Congress that says the federal government has to pay eligible physicians. And at the same time, there's another act, which is the imposition of this bar to judicial review. So how are we to understand these two actions, right? One says there's a mandatory obligation, and the other says there's no review. So So we think that the clear congressional intent of the mandatory shall pay language trumps whatever vague congressional intent there is in the judicial bar, which has this language of identification of primary care practitioners. The question
there are other statutory schemes that involve limitations like the one at issue here that say there should be no judicial review of this determination, right? I mean, this is not the first time Congress has ever done this. And Congress takes this kind of action because they don't want to see a lot of litigation over something involved in the scheme. They're allowed to do that, right?
Certainly. And so we think what Congress intended is evidenced by the plain words of the bar on to judicial review. It says identification of primary care practitioners. If it wanted to bar any claim relating to the PCIP in any form or fashion, it could have so stated by saying there shall be no judicial review, period. We think there was a carve-out intended here, and the purpose ultimately was, as you mentioned, the practical administration of the program. You don't want every physician under the plan contesting whether or not they're eligible. But that's not really what's happening here. What's happening here
is... Maine Community Health make it so that interpretation has been altered? How does Maine Community Health make, under Rule 60B, make it so that is a new argument, I suppose, that you have as a result of Maine Community Health? I don't think it is a new argument. I think it's the argument made all along. So I'm just having a hard time understanding, if that's your argument, how do I get that from Maine Community Health?
We think that Maine Community Health really announced a directive to the court that the federal government shouldn't be allowed to hide behind an independent act. Here it would be the bar to judicial review when a mandatory shall pay obligation is at issue. And so, of course, yes, it's not that there's no judicial bar in the Maine Community Health office.
Are you saying that Maine Community Health made this bar on judicial review impermissible?
Ultimately, no, Your Honor, we're not saying that. We're saying that Maine Community provides a roadmap to the lower court for how to construe this bar to judicial review narrowly as the law requires, and in light of the mandatory shall pay language, which according to me...
Wasn't that argument available to you before Maine Community?
Certainly, and we made it in opposition to the government's motion.
And you didn't appeal.
That's right, Your Honor. We didn't appeal. Certain tactical decisions...
If the argument was available to you prior, then how is it sufficient grounds for a Rule 60B? If the legal grounds were there for you to make, then Maine Community didn't make a change in the law. It may have given you additional citation, but it didn't change the law that made an otherwise unavailable argument suddenly available.
Your Honor, I think a change in law can either mean an actual change in law, right? The statute is overruled, but it can also mean just calling into question the correctness and viability of the court's logic. And we believe that's exactly what Maine Community Health Options did here. So I see that I'm running out of time and I need some time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll hear from Ms. Fomenkova.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. There are two independent but equally sufficient reasons to affirm the Court of Federal Claims denial of Rule 60B relief here. Number one is the subject of some discussion just now, which is that there has been no intervening change in the law. Maine Community was not about the primary care incentive payments. And just to be very clear, both before and after Maine Community, these incentive payments at issue here were only obligated to be paid to primary care physicians. Both before and after Maine Community, Dr. Feist was not a primary care physician in the CMS system. And both before and after Maine Community, judicial review was barred on the question of whether or not he should have been a primary care physician in the CMS system and therefore eligible for these payments.
Can I just ask, I know you want to, this is probably getting ahead to the next step. I was left in some confusion about this question, whether the statute guarantees the payments to someone, in fact, in the real world, is a primary position as that is defined by the substance of the work done, or whether it is limited to somebody who has some government computer coding or designation or identification in the government system. And those two things can be different if somebody who, in fact, is a primary care physician substantively doesn't have that designation in the government's computer system. First of all, which is it? And second, if it's the you have to have a designation in the system, what's the statutory language you're relying on?
So, Your Honor, I think in the first instance, I would say that's a little bit of a metaphysical question in light of the statutory bar that prohibits the court from addressing that issue. But what I would say sort of factually, I know that CMS has issued regulations that define who primary care physicians would be and how they would define the primary care physicians. And so the statute explicitly limits the primary care incentive payments to primary care physicians. CMS added regulations on top of that sort of to explain who would be considered primary care physicians. And Dr. Feist, for the 3 years that are at issue here, was not coded. And I think there's no dispute that sort of under the coding that he was in the system, he did not meet the regulatory definition of a primary care physician.
So I think I'm just going to repeat my question. Let's assume that all of the work that he did would qualify him to somebody who is correctly applying the standards as a primary care physician, but that on the other hand, he is not in fact coded in the system as such. So the coding is an error, is a mistake. Is he entitled under the statute to the benefit?
If it's a clerical error, the CMS allows.
Forget about how the error came about.
I think so long as he is in CMS as not coded as a primary care physician, he would not be entitled to payments under the statute.
Even though he would be substantively entitled to be so coded. I just try to understand what your view of the statute is and why that's correct if that's your view.
So, Your Honor, I think this. I think my primary view here is that question obviously doesn't matter.
I get that.
But I think that sort of that there is CMS issued regulations defining who a primary care physician would be.
Where are they?
So I know they're referenced in at appendix page 42 to 43, which is the letter that CMS wrote to Dr. Feist while this issue was being investigated at the time. And so they identify sort of how they define primary care physicians and why Dr. Feist did not meet that definition. And they reference an investigation that CMS performed and why it can and that sort of the results of that investigation were that they could not recode him and that there was not a clerical or mathematical error here. But the bottom line.
Can I just interrupt? Your view is it doesn't matter whether that was correct or not, there's no judicial review of that decision. Is that right?
Exactly, Your Honor. That question is one that has not been litigated in this case and cannot be litigated in any case because Congress explicitly and sort of the lower court said.
So let me ask you this hypothetical. Suppose the requirements to be a primary care physician were 1, 2, and 3. And there's no dispute that the physician meets 1, 2, and 3. But nevertheless, the government says, we're not going to give you the money you're owed under the statute, even if you undisputably meet 1, 2, and 3. Is your view they can't come to the Court of Federal Claims and say, we meet 1, 2, and 3, and therefore are entitled to the money?
So I think, Your Honor, it depends on whether they're so if, for example, you are coded, one of the 1, 2, and 3 is that you have.
I'm trying to get beyond the coding and get to their decision on entitlement. So the coding seems to me to be a technical way of describing what's going on here, which is they've made a determination that he's not entitled to be considered a primary care physician. And the question is, I understand your view is that that's not reviewable, but is that really the case if the statute says you get money if you meet, if you're a primary care physician, and they set out requirements for what they think a primary care physician is, and he's met all three of those? Again, speaking hypothetically.
Your Honor, I think he would not then meet all three of those because the regulations are that one of the requirements is that you have to be coded in CMS as a primary care physician.
Okay, so your view is, my hypothetical is not particularly helpful because one of the requirements to get payment would always be that you've been determined to be or you're designated a primary care physician by CMS.
Right. And if you haven't, so for example, if Dr. Feist had been a primary care physician in the CMS system and we hadn't paid him for some other reason, then we agree that that would not have been subject to the bar on judicial review, because then the sort of the first step in the inquiry is not, is he a primary care physician?
Isn't the logic of your decision then, if CMS makes a mistake that's undisputed on whether somebody's a primary care physician, then there's no judicial review of that mistake, even though it's clear somebody's entitled to these payments?
I mean, I think, Your Honor, that is the consequence of the express statutory bar. The bar was that there would be no judicial review of the identification of primary care physicians, and there's no sort of carve-out to that. So sort of necessarily that means that there is a that conceivably if there's a mistake, that mistake is not one that the courts can correct. And in this case, sort of the issue is that, and the court correctly originally identified.
Can I just ask, isn't the judicial bar supposed to limit the courts from looking at the facts of the case and saying you're a physician, primary care physician, you're not a primary care physician? But you're not saying that that's not what we can't decide, but you're saying what we can't decide is a checking of a box about whether you're a primary care physician or not.
Well, Your Honor, I think in this case, the sort of, if this case had been litigated, the question would have been the way that Your Honor formulated it originally. It would have been that the court would have to look at the facts that would be presented by Dr. Feist and the results of the investigation conducted by CMS, and then conclude who was correct as to whether or not he should have been designated as a primary care physician. And that's precisely...
That goes back to your view that whether he's a primary care physician is not undisputed here.
I don't think it's undisputed here, Your Honor. I think that question wasn't litigated because the court concluded that it couldn't have been litigated. And so the judge expressed certainly some views as to based on the evidence that was presented by Dr. Feist, but there was no other additional evidence presented because it was originally decided on a motion to dismiss. But more fundamentally, I would say that sort of because this is a Rule 60b-6 appeal and not a direct appeal, that really the question is whether Maine Community changed anything on that issue and whether or not the district court was correct in interpreting the bar on judicial review back in 2018. And we submit that he was correct then as well. Certainly, he did not.
I'm going to take you back to what I was asking just one last time, because I think what concerns me here is, and it sounds like you don't think this is a situation, but there's a situation where there can be no dispute whatsoever that the person, the doctor, is a primary care physician, that everything about the person's practice, what they do, how they bill, and somebody at CMS has just made a mistake and refuses to fix it. And it seems like the logic of your argument is, well, if CMS makes the mistake and refuses to fix it, no court can review that. Is that right?
I mean, I think, Your Honor, that is ultimately the result of the bar on judicial review. I think that CMS does have a mechanism. Their regulations allow them to fix clerical errors, for example, and mathematical errors. And so in that hypothetical, if it was that clear and it was just sort of a goof that somebody made in checking a final box, that there is a mechanism that existed for CMS to fix that. In this case, they, you know, undertook an investigation that Dr. Feist was involved with and concluded that there was not a clerical error, and that was sort of the basis of their original rejection of correcting what he perceives to be an error in his designation. But ultimately, sort of Maine Community did not change anything about the original analysis of this case. Dr. Feist characterizes the holding of Maine Community as the government is obligated to pay its debts. And we submit that was not a new pronouncement of law in 2020.
Ms. Farmakova, what do you think appendix page 43, the CMS letter, means when it says, we've looked at your records and we don't see a clerical or mathematical error? To a error in the designation that you had that might not have been a copying error, like a clerical one, or a addition or multiplication error, like a mathematical one. Is there something in this letter that indicates as a substantive matter, we looked at our record of your designation, it wasn't the qualifying one, and we don't really think that designation was wrong. Is there something that says that as opposed to somebody we don't see a copying error or an arithmetical error?
So, Your Honor, the language about sort of the clerical or mathematical error comes from CMS's regulations, and that was sort of the scope of errors that they felt they could correct in light of the bar on both because the bar covered both administrative and...
I understand that. We've been talking quite a lot, in fact, virtually the entirety, at least, of your argument about what kind of case this is. And the case is much more sympathetic to you if there actually was a CMS determination on the merits that the designation that was recorded was probably not wrong. And then there'd be a dispute, and then you'd say, well, that's exactly what this preclusion bar is supposed to prohibit. But I'm not sure we have anything like that. I'm not sure we have a case other than one in which it is undisputed that the designation was substantively erroneous.
So, Your Honor, I don't know the extent of which there is that sort of substantive dispute, in large part because that question wasn't litigated.
Tell me if I can find that substantive dispute in this 2014 CMS letter at appendix pages 42 and 43. It's almost unreadable.
I would note that the letter does say that the CMS reports spending a great deal of time researching all of the information that Dr. Feist has shared.
But I can't tell if it was looking for anything other than copying and arithmetic errors as opposed to looking at the work he actually did and deciding whether he belonged, in fact, properly belonged in a qualifying designation.
So, Your Honor, I think the reason we don't have that in the record here is because that question wasn't litigated. And the reason that question wasn't litigated is because Congress prohibited that question from being litigated. And ultimately, that prohibition has not been altered by Maine Community. Maine Community.
So your argument, so your defense here really does depend on saying that this preclusion bar precludes even a case of undisputed substantive error by CMS.
I think in this case, that would have been true if this was a direct appeal. I think because this is an appeal of Rule 60B denial, the problem is actually even a step earlier, which is that whether or not it's true, Maine Community did not change that. And Dr. Feist did not pursue that question on direct appeal. And therefore, the denial of the Rule 60B relief here was not an abuse of discretion and should be affirmed. And I see I'm out of time, so unless there are any other questions.
Thank you. Anything else? No. Okay, Ms. Key, you have how much time on rebuttal? Make it 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I think that the questioning really has the pertinent issue on appeal, at least with respect to the scope of the judicial bar, right on the head. How can it be that in light of mandatory shall pay language, an eligible practitioner who meets all of the requirements of the statute, he's been providing primary care services since 2002, and it's clear that Medicare knows that fact because it lists his designation as primary care on his Medicare claims themselves. cannot seek review of the erroneous determination of the government that he is not, in fact, eligible. We think that the scope of the statutory bar is clear. It is limited to claims concerning the identification of primary care practitioners. DML itself has taken the position that it's allowed to review claims relating to identification, even when they involve clerical errors or mathematical errors, but there is some sort of claim that can be looked at. We think that it's clear that where there is statutory shall pay language, there is a narrow inherent exception for claims like Dr. Feist's, who, when it is undisputed that they meet the requirements of the statute, that they be allowed a narrow avenue into the court to compel.
Right, and just try to say again how you think Maine community helps you get to that conclusion in a way that really wasn't so available before.
Sure, we think that Maine community health options announced exactly what is meant and the effect of that when the government when Congress uses shall pay language. It clarified that an external circumstance, there, in that case, it was Congress's decision not to earmark funds for the program. Here, the external circumstance is slightly more related, but it's the judicial bar, how that cannot affect the mandatory shall pay language. The rule is that the government shall pay, and it's the exception that certain claims are barred from judicial review. I see that I've run out of time, so unless you have any more questions, thank you.
No, thank you. We'll have to end there. Thank you to both counsel. The case is submitted.